In June 1950, when the communist government of North Korea attacked South Korea, Truman conferred promptly with his military advisors. There was, he wrote, complete, almost unspoken acceptance on the part of everyone that whatever had to be done to meet this aggression had to be done. There was no suggestion from anyone that either the United Nations or the United States could back away from it. The Korean War ended with a stalemate in 1953 with two heavily armed half-countries facing each other across a demilitarized zone. North and South Korea have evolved into very different countries, the South being a democracy, Americanized in many ways, the North a dictatorship, which occasionally threatens the West with its nuclear weapons. How did it all come about? And what are the dangers for the U.S. today? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
What did the Korean War accomplish? How big a threat is North Korea and its eccentric dictator Kim Jong-il today? And in a post-communist world economy, how much longer can the North last with its economy of all guns and no butter? Our guest is Jeremy Suri, professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and author of many books.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me on.
It does seem, when you think about how history is taught in the schools, that we often jump, it seems, from World War II and the Greatest Generation to Vietnam and the counterculture movement, and Korea often gets short shrift, which perhaps explains why we don't really understand what's going on today.
Right. I think that's right, Emily. I think it does get sandwiched between World War II and Vietnam. And also, it was a war that never really ended. And that's an important point, too. There never was a final settlement to the war. And so there never was closure. And so when you're teaching, and especially when you need to get through a lot of material, you can have a beginning and an end for World War II, and you can have a beginning and an end for Vietnam. But the sense of a lingering Korean War makes it difficult to fit into our ways of thinking about the Cold War world.
How far back does that split go, North and South?
Well, historians of Korea have argued, in fact, that you can trace it back a number of centuries, that there were different traditions of governance, different traditions of social organization, and different levels of Chinese and Japanese influence in the northern and southern sectors of the peninsula. And then it gets even more complicated if you include Manchuria, which for quite a while was separate from China itself. So in that sense, historians of Korea have taken this far back and argued that there were separate identities of Koreanness in Korea itself. The actual division, of course, politically, that's roughly the same as today's, comes out of the end of World War II. And it was largely a decision made in the State Department based upon where American and Soviet armies were at the
it's
end of the war.
A kind of arbitrary 38th parallel?
That's pretty much what it was. And this was true for many parts of Asia and Europe. At the end of the war, when American planners as well as Soviet planners were trying to figure out how to organize political authority after the war, they looked for easy demarcations of authority. And the 38th parallel made a lot of sense. There was no reason it had to be the 38th parallel and not the 38 and a half parallel. The armies were not exactly poised at that line, but it was a convenient place to divide things.
Well, before World War II, if you took a look at the Korean Peninsula, what was there and what were the Japanese and Chinese doing?
Well, before the late 19th century, what you had in Korea was what was called by many the Hermit Kingdom. It was a society that was under the rule of a series of local warlords and then a larger sort of apparatus that brought that together, within a Chinese sphere of influence for the most part. So it was what the Chinese would consider part of their larger kingdom, but not directly under the rule of the Chinese emperor. This would have been the same for much of Vietnam, for example, much of Burma, places of that kind. By the late 19th century, in particular by 1895, the Japanese begin to assert authority in the area and, of course, make Korea a colony in the early 20th century of their own. The story of Korea's movement from Chinese control to much more direct Japanese control is really the story of Chinese decline and imperial dissolution in the late 19th century and the rise of Meiji Japan. What's interesting as a part of that story that most Americans don't know is that there were a number of Americans who tried to, following Matthew Perry's visit to Japan, tried in the 1860s and 70s to establish American influence in Korea. My favorite case is William Henry Seward's son, George Seward, who led an expedition of a squadron, I should say, of American ships And it didn't work out. He wasn't able to open the Hermit Kingdom, not because of Chinese resistance as much as because of resistance within Korean society. This was a very, very closed society, a society that really lived in the Chinese shadow but also lived a very, shall we say, isolated existence beyond that.
So by the 1930s, the Japanese are in Manchuria to the north of Korea. How does that affect what happens to the Korean peninsula?
Well, by that point, by the 1930s, the Japanese are in direct control of Korea. They actually establish control there before Manchuria. You could basically plot Japanese expansion moving from Japan westward, in that sense, along the northwestern rim of Asia. What the Japanese use Korea for is a number of things. They use Korea, first of all, as a launching off point for movement to Manchuria, which is really their aim. Manchuria has the natural resources that they want. They also use Korea as a mechanism or as a place for expanding their naval power as well onto the Asian mainland or around the Asian mainland. And then third, they use Korean labor. And this is where the story of the comfort women and others comes in. Mm-hmm. Korea provides a labor-starved Japanese economy with a large, largely unskilled pool of labor that they can use for industrialization. So they build factories, for instance, there and use close-to-slave labor among Koreans to run those factories.
And what difference does geography make? You know how you see sometimes the Korean War referred to as the Battle of the Hills and all the rest of it, but are there unique features about Korean geography that kind of play into what happens politically?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that Korea was never fully integrated into China is that the geography is a very difficult geography for a foreign invader to work with. It's mountainous. As you get up north, it's very, very cold. You have a lot of sea access, but you don't actually have a lot of very good ports. It's a very difficult area to move into and control. In that sense, it's not the same, but I do think of it as Italy a little bit, right? A long, thin peninsula that's mountainous, a terrain that's not easy to move through. Contrast that with Poland. So it's a very difficult terrain to work in, and this is very relevant for post-World War II and the Korean War, because one of the problems that both the Americans and the Soviets have is trying to figure out how you can assert authority effectively in Korea without a major expenditure of soldiers. And in fact, by 1949, the United States is convinced it can't do that and withdraws its soldiers. We're providing a great deal of aid to Syngman Rhee, the South Korean, really, dictator. We call him a Democrat, but he wasn't. He was a dictator. But American forces are actually withdrawn from South Korea, in large part because Secretary of State Dean Acheson and President Harry Truman come to the conclusion that it's too costly to have our forces here.
So how did the Japanese then, when you say they were in control, how exactly are they staying in control? Is it with tanks equivalent? I mean,
The Japanese pursued, quite frankly, an incredibly brutal militarization campaign, the same thing they did on the Chinese mainland. Historians argue that what you see in Korea from 1905 in particular to 1937 is a precursor, in a sense, a practice run for what you see in Manchuria and then in Nanking. They send in thousands of soldiers to take village by village and to basically kill anyone who is a potential dissenter or problem person. So it is an absolutely brutal policy. You can rule that way. But that's not the way, for all kinds of reasons, that the United States or the Soviets want to maintain authority after the war.
But we already have this distinction of North versus South.
Right.
In Korea.
Absolutely. That's already there, but it doesn't necessarily align with the political boundaries, and that's what World War II does. World War II creates a situation where this perhaps pre-existing sense of different Koreanness gets now institutionalized, and institutionalized not just in where the military forces end, but in separate governments. The Soviets creating a communist pro-Soviet government, the United States creating under Syngman Rhee a pro-American government.
So essentially the United States at the end of World War II is firmly entrenched in Japan, so they're in a position to have as their client state South Korea.
Yes. Yeah, there are two reasons why that's done. I mean, one is to protect Japan. There's a perception that if this entire peninsula is under Soviet authority, Dean Acheson says it will be a dagger pointing at Japan. And you can see how the geography would lead one to think that.
Is this Soviet through China, though?
No, it's by
sea.
It's mostly direct Soviet influence because North Korea borders both, in fact, right? So the Soviets are actually able to exert a fair amount of influence. This is before the Chinese Communist Revolution of 48-49, the successful end to that, which of course changes the calculus as well. But the United States, secondly, is also seeking to pursue after World War II, a strategy of maritime hegemony in Asia, which is to say not to be a land power in Asia but to control the sea lanes. And that's the experience of World War II. The way we defeated the Japanese over the long haul was actually by controlling the sea. Right, we tried not to fight on land. That's why we used the atomic bomb. Right, we tried to jump from island to island. And so the strategy after the war is to continue to do that. And the way to do that is to prevent anyone else from having major sea access and sea dominance. And that's why you want to control the area around Formosa and South Korea.
Is any of what happens at the end of World War II in Korea a sort of punitive measure against Japan?
Not really, because you know the Koreans are victims, actually. Mm-hmm. I think insofar as the United States is worried about Japanese rearmament, they're worried about the Koreans suffering again in the same way that they worry, for instance, about the Poles suffering mm-hmm. again. But quite frankly, in the materials I've read, that doesn't come up so much. I think the geostrategic issues are most prominent. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm not sure that American policymakers really care that much about the Korean people. They're much more concerned about strategy and stability in the area.
And what is it that makes it a sort of uniquely Korean place? In other words, if you've got Japan on one side and you've got Manchuria and China and so on, what unique features, either in terms of culture or other things, make it a different entity?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, one thing that makes it so unique, it seems to me, as a non-expert on Korean society itself, is just that it's at the crossroad of these two societies, and that makes it very interesting. The other thing about Korea is there is a strong sense, even though there are differences within Koreans, of Korean independence because of this experience of being in between. And it's a society that, unlike Japan, did not, at least until after World War II, go through a period of rapid westernizing modernization. And so that differentiates it from Japan in important ways and differentiates it from China, whereas China had this imperial tradition, a sort of a greatness of centuries past to hold on to. Korea didn't have that. So it's an interesting cultural blending in a certain way, I think.
By 1947, 49, China's revolution is accomplished, communist revolution, and I suppose with that, a sense of national unity and then a sense of actually regional dominance.
Absolutely. This is crucial in understanding the development of U.S. and Soviet policy. We know on the Soviet side now that after the Chinese Communist Party comes to power in late 48, early 49, Soviet leadership, Joseph Stalin, thinks that actually the future of the revolution is in Asia, not in Europe. And he begins to increase support to Kim Il-sung, the Soviet-chosen leader of North Korea, who has been arguing for a unification war since the end of World War II. So is Syngman Rhee in the South. Both of these guys after the war, both chosen leaders of North and South Korea, want to go to war to unite their peninsula. And Stalin begins to contemplate this now, believing that the future of the revolution is in Asia. And ultimately, when the war starts, it is with direct Soviet and Chinese, communist Chinese approval and support. For instance, Soviets provide aircraft. On the American side, the so-called, quote-unquote, loss of China, which is a strange phrase because it was never ours to lose, but the so-called loss of China creates a major problem for the Truman administration. Truman and Acheson have just withdrawn American forces from Korea, and they become the focus of intense criticism by both parties for being too weak on communism.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to withdraw, isn't it? Just as China is coming into its own, we pull out of
exactly,
Korea.
Exactly. And so that calculus, that context has to be kept in mind when we think about American reactions to the Korean War. It was incredibly difficult for Truman to do anything but react strongly in that context when he's already been accused of being weak. He's lost China. The people in the Senate are beginning to say, you're going to lose Korea too. What about Japan next? So that context on both sides is very important, and that's where the Chinese Communist Revolution changes the calculus strategically but also in American domestic politics.
What kind of government is South Korea at this point?
It's a government with a quote-unquote president, Syngman Rhee, who is a South Korean, educated actually at Princeton, sent back with American support to take control. And he really is a dictator. He is not as brutal as the North Korean leader, but that's only because Kim Il-sung is so much more brutal. I mean, Syngman Rhee jailed, killed, disappeared opponents within. He repressed the communist and labor parties. He established a very centralized, militarized regime. He was, by 1950, our proxy in the area.
When we see the beginning of the war listed as June 25th, 1950, what is it that leads up to that day?
Well, this is where historians debate a lot. There are some historians who say that actually you shouldn't talk about a beginning of the war in June 1950 because you've already got these different visions of Korea going back before World War II, and then they just become institutionalized with the war. And there's something to that. But I disagree on that, because what does change in June 1950 is that the Soviet Union and the Chinese communist leadership, in conjunction with Kim Il-sung, make a decision that they're going to put full force right now into unifying the peninsula. They had a long-term vision of that, as did the American-supported regime, at least in South Korea. But now they decide they're going to move on it.
Why?
Well, a couple of things happen. First of all, the Chinese Communist Revolution creates this sense of euphoria. We can do this. And secondly, there's a perception of American weakness. And we see this in that what we now have of the dialogue between Stalin and Mao and Kim Il-sung, a sense in which the United States is pulling back and this is the time to move. Secretary of State Dean Acheson, in defending American policy in the context of China in January 1950, January 12, 1950, I think, gives a famous speech to the National Press Club, where he talks about this American maritime defense perimeter. And he leaves out Korea as a place that we'll defend intentionally. His argument was that we were not going to fight on land. He emphasized Formosa. He emphasized Japan. He emphasized, to some extent, the area around Vietnam. But he left out Korea. And we know that Stalin and Mao read the speech. And so they thought this was a time to move. Now, I think there are major miscalculation, and again, why I see June 1950 as such a breaking point, is they decided to do it all at once. They decided to do it with a massive attack on the South.
Is there a border at this point?
Yeah, 38th parallel.
It's still 38th. Even then.
With a clear demarcation? I mean, what does it look like physically?
As far as I know, there was not a demilitarized zone as there is now, but there was an actual border, like the one between East and West Germany that had been created at the end of the war. And there had been American and Soviet soldiers on the border. Now there were North Korean and South Korean soldiers on this border. Mm-hmm. And they basically rammed through the border and pushed down south, pushing South Korean forces to the little corner of Busan in the southeast region of South Korea.
Total surprise?
Yes and no. I mean, total surprise the extent to which they did this. There were, as there always are when you have major military movements, there were signs a few days, even weeks in advance. And there are conspiracy theorists out there. So, you know, the same guys who knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen
right.
knew this was going to happen. But what was a surprise certainly to the White House, to Truman and Acheson, was the extent of this frontal attack. It was a kind of blitzkrieg. And I would say if there was one big mistake that the North Koreans and the Soviets and the Chinese made, it was that. They could have actually probably through infiltration and slowly established authority in the South. The United States was pulling back at this point, at least up until the 52 election. They had a window when Truman was trying to cut the military budget and not get involved. But this kind of quote-unquote naked aggression made Truman and Acheson believe they had no choice but to react for strategic reasons, but also for domestic political reasons. Again, they had just, quote-unquote, lost China. Could they allow South Korea to fall in a matter of days in the eyes of the American people? Probably not.
Let's get into this whole question of the United Nations and the Korean War when we return in a moment. This is University of the Year.
The news, the music, the discussions you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio often trigger a need for more information. It's available at 1-800-747-7444. Audience Services, 1-800-747-7444.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Jeremy Suri, and we're dealing this hour with Korea, and inevitably now with the Korean War, which began, according to most accounts, with an attack across that 38th parallel from the north, June 25th, 1950. North Korea was geographically close to Soviet Union, to China, South Korea, more with Japan, which was heavily influenced by the United States. And then we also have, and this is strange in retrospect, the United Nations
Yes.
involved in this war. How did all these factions fit together?
What happens is when the North Koreans with Soviet and Chinese support attack on June 25th, 1950, the initial reaction comes from the United States and South Korea and then Japan insofar as the American forces that are stationed in the area are actually stationed in Japan. So the first American forces to arrive in Korea come from Japan itself, and that's, of course, where General Douglas MacArthur is at the time. But Truman then immediately brings us to the Security Council, which at that point is not meeting in New York City, but in Lake Placid, New York. And the Soviets do not come to the Security Council meeting. And this is another thing historians have looked at. Why don't they show up? They don't show up in part because they screwed up. They missed the meeting as these things happen. But also it appears as if Stalin didn't understand what was going to happen at the Security Council meeting. It wasn't really – because this was the first case of the UN Security Council really voting for an intervention. The United States pushed the Security Council for, under UN authority, a international intervention to protect the sovereignty of South Korea, which was recognized as a sovereign state within the United Nations. And a Security Council without the Soviet veto votes to authorize this action. So General Douglas MacArthur then immediately becomes retitled. He already thought of himself as Emperor of Japan. He now gets retitled UN Supreme Commander in Korea. And other states now contribute forces, small forces, but symbolically important forces to this. So, for instance, Turkey sends a contingent. Pakistan sends a contingent. Australia sends a contingent of soldiers to fight with this. It's a largely American and South Korean war predominantly, but you get these other symbolic contributions, and it provides a sense of legitimacy, a strong sense of legitimacy for this undertaking. It is a UN action.
And that's the first time that's ever happened, right?
That is the first time, and it is the only time during the Cold War it happens. The Soviets will never again miss a vote, nor will the Americans. I mean, it's not just the Soviets that later on will veto these actions. The Americans will at times, too. It's the only case where the UN, during the Cold War, it's of course happened after, during the Cold War, where the United Nations authorizes large-scale military intervention against a major power, in this case, a Soviet-supported power.
Of course, China not a player at all in the United Nations.
At that time, Taiwan. It's the government of Taiwan that actually sits in the Chinese seat.
Well, let's talk about General Douglas MacArthur, since he's going to get in a little bit of trouble later on and so on. But tell us about his personality, his approach before Korea, and how that influences what happens.
Well, the most important thing I always say about General Douglas MacArthur is you have to understand he had not been back to the United States since the early 1930s. This was a man sent over to the Philippines to oversee American forces in the Philippines about the time Roosevelt becomes president. And he had not been back to the United States. He never came back after World War II. So by the time of the Korean War, he's actually been in Asia almost 20 years. He thinks of himself as an independent operator. He believes that he knows Asia better than any American.
Including, certainly, of course, the president.
Certainly a sort of a Missouri country bumpkin whose president doesn't know any better than he does. He's accustomed to acting pretty independently. In that time, you can imagine how difficult it was to communicate from Washington to Asia, how difficult it was to oversee what this man was doing. So he thinks of himself as being an expert. He thinks of himself as being independent. And he's a firm believer, and he writes this and says this all the time, that the quote-unquote Asian mind only reacts to force. And so this is the way he approaches issues. Now, historians looking back would say that none of these things proved to be true during World War II. He did not actually, let's say, successfully defend the Philippines in 1941.
He was surprised also.
I was surprised then as well, so much for his expertise on Asia. And most analyses of his military campaigns are not likely now to claim him to be any kind of military genius either. Much of the successful fighting in Asia was done on sea by the United States, not necessarily on land. But nonetheless, MacArthur sees himself as this great oracular figure in the area. And so when the war breaks out, his inclination is to decide how he's going to react and then tell the president rather than ask the president first.
And how does he react?
Well, what he does is he begins by trying to sort of send Band-Aid forces from Japan that are poorly trained and not prepared onto the peninsula. And then he begins to mount what he hopes will be a grand attack on the peninsula in one fell swoop, basically. And this is the Incheon landing that he's planning very early
on. Is this an outflanking maneuver?
It's an outflanking maneuver, and it's designed to be a kind of decisive battle, right?
Come in behind the North Korean lines.
Come around the peninsula and in behind on the western coast of Korea. And coming back to MacArthur's sense of the importance of image and force for the Asian mind, instead of gradually building, right, having this one decisive move where you show them that they can't win and then they fold their cards, so to speak. And that's what he begins to plan for. Most of the major military minds in the United States are skeptical about this. The irony is, with the Incheon landing in the fall of 1950, he originally seems to be right. American forces do land at Incheon, and they do flank the North Korean forces. And very soon, by close to Thanksgiving, American forces are up at the Chinese border and control the whole peninsula. MacArthur claims that the United States at this point should not simply stick to its UN mandate, that Asians respond to force, and that the United States should take the whole peninsula and even perhaps, you know, scare the Chinese a little bit. Again, everyone around Truman is very, very concerned about this, but doesn't know how to control MacArthur. There's this famous visit that MacArthur and Truman have in Wake Island, which is also amazing, right? He doesn't come back to the United States, MacArthur. When Truman wants to meet with him, Truman's got to go out. And they've got to find an island somewhere in between.
Convenient for MacArthur.
Exactly, exactly. And the story is also that the two planes are circling and MacArthur refuses to land first, wants the president to land first. And finally, MacArthur lands first. This is a moment where he wants the president to land first to greet him rather than him greeting the president. Truman is quite frankly intimidated by MacArthur and doesn't follow through on his own inclination to scale back American operations.
So is it true or not that at this meeting Truman kept waiting, says General MacArthur, I don't give a damn what you think about Harry Truman, but don't ever keep the president of the United States waiting again?
This is, I think, one of these apocryphal Truman stories. He doesn't, as far as I've seen in the record, he's very hesitant to say anything critical to MacArthur. You would think, looking at that record, not that Truman's a, you know, a pushover, right, but that MacArthur's as much in that meeting. What Truman said later to, I think, Clifford Elsey, which I think was probably his truest comment on the meeting, was, I just want to get out of there as fast as I could. Get this done with and get out of there. So MacArthur, his personality comes through in the way the war is operated. I mean, it's undertaken as an act of glory, an act of independent local authority, and MacArthur does not really consult with American expertise on this.
Or with the UN.
With the UN.
I mean,
right.
What about technology? Is there new technological advance that makes, in terms of the weaponry, the use of jets and so on, is the war different because of technology?
It's mostly fought as a kind of World War II engagement. The bombing is a little more, I don't want to say accurate, it's a little more extensive or a little more effective per bombing run. But that's just a result of what was happening at the end of World War II. The improvements and the greater use of aerial bombardment, that carries over into the Korean War. In many ways, I think it's really the last war fought like World War II. And I'll give two examples of this. One is Omar Bradley, who, of course, great hero from World War II, who's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for a short time during the Korean War. He actually suggests using tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield in actual engagements in a World War II sort of fashion, not understanding how different these weapons are, not understanding the technological differences. And then the second thing that strikes me as also a kind of World War II approach to it is the way in which, at least early on, MacArthur's approach is not to think about civilian casualties at all, but to think about pushing the enemy off particular territory. And that, of course, makes some sense. But what becomes a big problem in Korea and every subsequent war is the resistance from civilians within areas that are occupied. And that's something MacArthur doesn't think about because he didn't really deal with that in Japan. There really wasn't resistance.
See, these are not strictly uniformed armies. There are also guerrilla fighting?
There is some, but it's still mostly the main engagements and the main fighting is still army to army. It's not a counterinsurgency or an insurgency conflict as we'll get into in Vietnam. So no, it's more, again, it's more a face-to-face army to army engagement like World War II. The only complicated thing is the armies are running up and down the peninsula.
So what kind of strategy do we come up with if MacArthur is saying, let's take the whole peninsula, push the Chinese, and the Americans, Truman, Acheson and company, are reluctant? What's the result?
Well, first of all, MacArthur gets his way early on, pushes up the peninsula. Then the Chinese enter the war in October, November 1950, push the Americans back down the peninsula. And then we end up, by late 1950-51, in a classic war of attrition, which is to say stable lines that don't move very much, but heavy engagements along those lines, heavy casualties. From early 1951 till the settlement in July 53, the lines hardly move. After 6 months of running up and down the peninsula, the lines hardly move, but it remains a deadly war. There are tens of thousands of people who die for very little territory exchanged. So in that sense, you could argue it even brings us back to a kind of World War I trench warfare war, in a sense. So we come actually to a point where we don't really have much of a strategy in 1951. And this is where the United States finds itself. We find ourselves in a situation where we're engaged in this major UN operation.
Ground war in Asia.
Exactly.
Right, exactly what they were trying to avoid. And against the Chinese, you would think the Chinese could bring unlimited personnel, if not weaponry, to this.
Well, that's what they did. It was the Chinese were very underarmed, but they had numbers. They had numbers, and they also understood the terrain very well. The Americans, especially those in late 1950 who are fighting up north, they have a hard time fighting in the cold up there. I mean, it's mountainous, it's cold. I've read some of the oral histories and talked to some of these soldiers, and they had a very hard time operating. The equipment wouldn't work. The Chinese had a big advantage in being under-equipped. They weren't reliant upon these things working, and they were able. They seemed to be able to manage. We really don't know the inner history of the Chinese army, but from what we can tell, they seem to operate in that environment better than American soldiers did.
I've seen a quotation attributed to Omar Bradley about the Korean War where he called it the wrong war at the wrong place at the wrong time and with the wrong enemy.
Right, right.
Was that sort of looking back at it?
That's looking back at it. Omar Bradley was criticizing the United States for first being unprepared and then for when we fought, not really fighting in the right way. But that's a retrospective comment. At the time, Bradley was struggling like everyone else to make sense of this.
And were the protests at home at any point as it became clear that it wasn't really going anywhere and that people were losing lives?
Well, this is what people forget about the Korean War. Coming back to your initial point, Emily, early on there aren't. Early on there's a rally around Truman mentality. And then when MacArthur is dismissed, you get a kind of controversy over MacArthur or Truman. And
this
it was
is
a very
what, 52?
51.
51.
And he's replaced by Matthew Clark. But you don't get protests. What you do get in 51 and 52 is a very, very unpopular war. Truman faces a great deal of opposition and criticism on the right and the left, which is to say those who think we're not fighting hard enough, those who agree with MacArthur, and there's talk of a MacArthur run for presidency in 52, and then those on the other side who aren't necessarily liberal. They could be people like Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, Mr. Conservative, who says we should never be fighting over there. Right? And it was wrong for the Truman administration to get us into this. Truman faces criticism on both sides, and he has no answer in the sense he has no way of showing the war is getting any better.
Truman decides not to run for re-election. He could have, but it would have been, in effect, a third term, but
right.
Constitutionally fine right. In 1952. What makes him decide not to run?
Well, I think the main thing is that, I mean, he had decided that he wasn't going to, I think, regardless of the Korean War, that he wasn't going to seek a third term as such. But he was terribly unpopular in 51. Now, I want to be careful. If you looked at it in 47, you would have thought he'd lose in 48, too. So you have to be very careful about these things. But his popularity rating in 51 is so low. He's being criticized so heavily in large part because of this war, which is a terribly unpopular war at the time, that that had to add to his inclination not to run again. But the Korean War, and this is a really important point, it fits the norm for American wars. Which is to say Americans get involved in a war. It's popular initially. And then within, I would say, 12 months or so, the war becomes very unpopular. World War II is the exception. That has to be stressed, right? It's the only war where you don't have that in American history. Korean War is, in that sense, a smaller scale Vietnam, a smaller scale War of 1848, smaller scale Spanish-American War, where you have a lot of discomfort with the war.
And what triggered MacArthur's dismissal? I mean, the signs had been there for a long time that he was acting independently and so on. So what triggered
that? He crossed the line when he publicly criticized the President of the United States.
The Commander-in-Chief.
MacArthur, when things started to go poorly in the northern part of Korea after the Chinese entered the war, MacArthur argued the United States should consider using nuclear weapons and should take the war further north, which is to say onto Chinese territory. And Truman said no way, and MacArthur communicated with American senators, and his information or his communications with American senators became public, explicitly criticizing, and it should also be said, committing himself not to follow the president's orders. It wasn't just that he criticized the president. He actually challenged the president's authority. No president could allow that. Truman was courageous to remove him, but in fact, Truman had no choice. I don't see how any president could allow that.
That does raise the question, though, if MacArthur, in effect, is trying to be a Secretary of State and conduct American foreign policy, what was going on in terms of foreign policy, if anything, to try to end the war?
Well, early on, after the North Korean invasion, there really isn't much diplomacy except at the UN to get a coalition organized, and then the United States is fighting. And in fact, those first few months are pretty desperate. Initially, it looks like our South Koreans are going to get pushed off the peninsula. And then once we're off the peninsula, it's much harder to fight your way back on, of course. Then there's a moment of euphoria after Incheon. 51, you begin to get, with the stalemate, you begin to get negotiations, protracted negotiations. But there are two big problems for diplomacy. First of all, the United States has no relations with communist China. We refuse to recognize them. So it's impossible for us to talk to them. And of course, we have no relations with North Korea. And relations with the Soviet Union at this point are particularly bad also.
End of the Stalin era.
End of the Stalin era. And we now know, I don't think the Truman administration knew this, Stalin was pretty much close to incapacitated by 52, and so you have this interregnum. It's not surprising, by the way, that the war does end. Negotiations do move forward in 53 after Stalin departs from the scene. So that's an important variable in here as well. So 51, 52, you have diplomacy through attempted negotiation, but there really isn't much effective diplomacy for these various reasons.
So it has to be really through Stalin's successors who then would work with China to bring it to an end.
Yeah, to some extent. And the other problem, and this is true for every subsequent American war, we have to also negotiate effectively with our allies. Syngman Rhee becomes a big problem for us at a number of levels. First, in 1952, when there's something close to perhaps an agreement on a ceasefire, Syngman Rhee, who's holding thousands of Chinese and North Korean POWs, prisoners of war, decides he's going to release them and let them choose where they want to go. Right? Brilliant PR move. Total problem. It undermines the negotiations because the Chinese and the North Koreans, they know that these prisoners of war don't want to come back in many cases, but they don't want to let them go off wherever they want to go. And the United States doesn't want Syngman Rhee to do this either, but he starts to do it anyway, for example, because he doesn't want a negotiated end. He wants the United States to put more force in and to defeat the North Koreans. So in that sense, it's a precursor to what we'll see in Vietnam, where one of the biggest problems is controlling our own ally. Excellent.
We're going to talk about the end, or was there an end, of the Korean War and its legacy today when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
If you want to know more about HD Radio, there's an article on HD that you'll find at WPR.org, as well as answers to frequently asked questions and related HD Radio links, all at WPR.org.
The Korean War has always been an unpopular war among the American people. A comment by Paul Robeson. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Jeremy Suri, and we're talking about the Korean War. You mentioned before, Jeremy, that the war doesn't really end officially, and that's one of the reasons we have trouble talking about it or teaching it. So where do historians sort of mark the end?
Well, that's a very good question. Most historians would say, I think, that July 1953, when you have the conclusion of the talks at Panmunjom and you have a ceasefire as such, marks the end of one phase. I mean, you could argue that, in fact, there were multiple phases of the war. Perhaps there was an early pre-1950 phase of low-level conflict. Then there's the actual war itself of heavy fighting. And then after 1953, what you have is a return to low-scale conflict, but continued conflict nonetheless. It's significant that there's no settlement because that means that the North and South Korean regimes and their respective allies do not recognize the other as being legitimate and that they claim the right to explicitly try to undermine the alternative regime. And that's exactly what happens henceforth. From 1953 on, you will have continued raids across the border. You'll have continued efforts to, through economic warfare, political warfare, propaganda, undermine the other regime. And the Korean Peninsula will remain one of the most militarized areas in the world. And, of course, it's now coming close to becoming a nuclear – in fact, is partially a nuclear militarized zone. It's quite ironic when the whole settlement in Japan is about demilitarizing Japan. In essence, you could argue that all the military force that had been organized around Japan – is now shifted around Korea in many ways.
And once we get into the 1950s, the United States, I think, pretty much alone. There may be a couple of other countries involved, but you certainly don't hear about them as about the United States armed to the teeth in South Korea. The North Koreans have this reputation of being nothing but a military.
It's true that the North Koreans will continually spend a much higher proportion of their smaller GNP on military force and get an enormous amount of aid from the Chinese and the Soviets. But the South Korean regime is, in comparison to what we're accustomed to in the U.S., is a very militarized regime. Until actually about a year or two ago, there was a huge American military base in the center of Seoul, which was something we would never tolerate in the United States. Part of it is because of Seoul's proximity to the border. So there is a heavy military presence around that is very strong, South Korean Secret Service, things of that sort. But what is different, and I think needs to be emphasized, is that in the aftermath of the Korean War, the United States puts a major effort into economic development in South Korea, in Taiwan, and other parts of Asia.
As they had done in Japan.
As they had done in Japan, exactly. This is, I would argue, the biggest shift that comes out of the war. The United States in 1948-49 is trying to maintain strategic control of the sea in this area and protect Japan. The United States does not. Truman does not want to underwrite economic growth in this area. He wants to cut the budget and not focus on that. After the war, Americans become convinced that we have to build a strong, vibrant set of capitalist economies with some kind of democracy in Asia. And so we underwrite, through military means but also through economic aid, the development of the South Korean economy, the development of the Taiwanese economy. We try this in South Vietnam. It doesn't work quite as well there. But South Korean economic growth, South Korea becoming one of the 15 richest countries in the world, is actually an American-sponsored program after the Korean War.
How do the resources compare, North and South?
Well, the South is clearly in a better situation on a number of levels. It's better arable land. It has more access to the major shipping lanes for trade and things of that sort. But in general, Korea is not a resource-rich area. It's like Japan in that sense. It benefits from being an entrepot for trade. And in the South, it benefits from American-sponsored labor productivity, the building of new factories, the creation of new technological know-how, the creation of a late industrial or post-industrial society, the infrastructure for which is laid by the U.S. It is the follower to Japan in that. And the other thing that happens, which is really important, is Japan comes to underwrite some of this. So some critical South Korean scholars say there's actually a second Japanese imperialism because Japanese money starts to flow in there. But it's complicated because the Japanese great economic growth of the 1950s is because of the Korean War, too. When the United States is fighting in Korea, it starts pouring money into Japan to pay for American military activities. Japan becomes the staging force. And so the Japanese economy enters this period of rapid growth because of American spending in Japan during the Korean War. And then the Japanese economic wealth that's created by that gets filtered into South Korea. So you get this chain of influence in that area as a consequence of the Korean War. I would argue that changes the world. That, to me, is the turning point in the Cold War. Without that shift that we just described, there's no Vietnam War, because that's what makes the threat to Vietnam so threatening for the U.S.
We hear a lot about what it was like for Vietnam vets to come home and the attitudes that they encountered. What about Korean veterans who are coming back? How do they feel and how are they treated?
It's another great question. And I should say there's a lot of interesting work that's being done on this. Wisconsin Public Television just did a show on Wisconsin Korean War stories. And they have a book coming out, I think, in a year with oral histories from Wisconsin vets who describe just this. In some ways, they talk in similar form to Vietnam veterans about coming home and it being a war that no one wanted to talk about. They weren't spit at, but most Vietnam veterans weren't really spit at. They had this incredible experience, this experience that transformed their lives, and then they came back and people didn't want to talk about it. People had trouble identifying with it. And that is a similarity. There also is, I think, a sense of betrayal that many of them have, a sense of being out there and not feeling that they were well supported, not really knowing why they were fighting at a certain level.
And if you look at it with hindsight now, if you look at the Korean War, the way we've seen sometimes America will go into a region without understanding its language, its history, the complicated cultural situation. When you look at the Korean War, to what extent do you think, I guess, racism, Orientalism plays a role? Other things where it's a sort of lack of understanding of the region.
Sure. That definitely plays a role at a number of levels. Douglas MacArthur is the clearest example of this. He this his discussion of the Asian mind, his belief that you could just sort of ram American force through there. And even though later military leaders and political leaders will not be as, shall we say, as extreme as MacArthur, many of his ideas still carry through. And so there is a lot of that. But I should also say that, you know, my sense looking at the documents and stuff from the Korean War is that while there was a lot of that there, there also was a lot of expertise and knowledge of Korea, more than in most subsequent wars, certainly more than in Vietnam, because we had just been occupying there. A lot of American effort had been put into understanding that region during World War II and after it. Now, of course, within that effort, there was racism and Orientalism built in, but there was a fair amount of expertise. People sort of knew what they were getting into. I don't think the problem was a lack of understanding as much as it was the people making decisions not listening to those who had the understanding of the area. And I would even transfer that to later conflicts as well. It's getting the right people to talk to the right decision makers.
Well, the North and the South both are always going to be affected by the adjacent states, superpowers in some cases. And, of course, the behavior of those super states has changed over the years.
Sure, sure.
And certainly the Soviet Union is far different place than it was at the time of this war now more than 50 years ago.
Well, now it's Russia, first of all.
That's right, that's right.
It might be going back.
But back to 1905, yeah, maybe. And China, if anything, is more of a militaristic unified entity than it was then.
Mm-hmm.
How is that affecting the stalemate between North and South?
Well, certainly the end of the Soviet Union and the, shall we say, decrease in Soviet influence is significant, because during the 1970s and 80s, when the North Koreans would undertake, quite frankly, terrorist acts and things like that, trying to assassinate the South Korean premier, seizing American ships, stuff of that sort, the Soviets were really trying to, in the era of detente, control them. What the Soviets, like the United States, didn't want were loose cannons out there. And so they were actually a source of order. They were not in 1950, but they became a source of order. And most discussions of Korea would often involve the U.S. and the Soviet Union sitting down and agreeing on something and then trying to get the two Koreas to agree to it. With the Soviet Union out of the picture, it actually complicates things in that sense. China and the changes China has gone through also complicate things. On the one hand, China now asserts its role and probably its legitimate role as a major regional power, and wants to actually have its own policy respected by the United States and its own interests. It has a very strong interest in what happens in Korea because of the border they share. The last thing the Chinese want is a collapse of Korea, because that becomes a refugee problem for them, and that's the last thing they want. And they watched what happened when East Germany collapsed, and they don't want to see the same thing in North Korea. At the same time, the Chinese now, I think, are tired of propping up the North Korean regime. They're the last friend the North Koreans have, and they provide, for example, the energy for that society. It's a starving society, but a society that has nuclear weapons. It's using a large amount of energy, and that energy is provided at low cost or free by the Chinese, and I don't think the Chinese want to do that forever. So this complicates things also. They don't want the regime to fall, which is why they're very critical of American pressure on that regime. But they don't want the regime to just go on as it is.
So this is a very delicate balance. Something has to give fairly soon.
Exactly.
Especially with a leader like Kim Jong-il, it seems to me. I mean, is he as wacky as he seems?
Loose cannons.
It's hard, you know, it's hard to say because we know so little about him that's substantive. It's certainly clear that he cultivates the image of irrationality as a source of power. And his father did this to some extent, but I think he does it even more, which is to say that he believes he can get more by appearing to be someone who's uncontrollable and that you better not push him too far. And this is a game he plays. It's a very dangerous game, but he plays it, we should recognize, very, very intelligently.
Right? It's about all he has to work with,
well,
I
that's
guess.
Exactly it. It's the power of the weak, in a sense. He says, I'm desperate, I'm weak, and so you better watch out. Because as much as his society is suffering, he can do an enormous amount of damage to South Korea and now to Japan. And that's his card. That's his trump card, really. And the more we believe he's crazy and could do it, the stronger it makes him in that situation. Mm. So I'm sure he is wacko in the sense that he was raised in this cocoon, right, in this poor society with access to all this wealth, with no inhibitions upon his prurient activities, upon his personal behavior. So I'm sure that's created a warped psychology. But we should also recognize the diplomatic acumen he's been able to use.
So what are the lessons of the Korean War then? We're in 2007. We're looking back at this period of time in the 50s. What are the lessons?
Well, I think as I look at it, I think there's certainly three that jump out to me. I mean, one is that it's very, very important in this region to work in a way that brings together a lot of groups. I think any kind of unilateral policy, as MacArthur tried to pursue or as the North Koreans tried to pursue, is a recipe for disaster. There are too many interests intertwined here, and no matter how strong you are, you can't force your way in this region. So the first lesson is the need for multilateral diplomacy of some kind or another. The Korean War happened because that wasn't there. It was prolonged because it wasn't there. Things have only remained stable when there was multilateral diplomacy. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is I do think the war should caution us against a belief that you can maintain stability in this area without the use of force in the short run. Now, this is not to advocate for war, but it is to say that there has to be some military presence in the area to maintain authority. I'm opposed to the withdrawal of American forces there, though I support scaling back, moving out of Seoul. I think it was terrible. We had our main base in Seoul itself. So I support pulling our forces back. But I think our forces are actually one of the main sources of stability in that region, and I think the worst thing we could do would be to withdraw them. I think in retrospect, withdrawing forces in 49 was premature, even though the right intention was at work. And then the third lesson that I would put out there is I would say that we shouldn't presume that these regimes have to last forever. The other approach is to say, you know, let's just stabilize things as they are. Let's give the North Koreans a security guarantee. Let's do what we can to continue to prop up the South Korean government, though it doesn't need our support anymore. I think we should recognize that these are ephemeral regimes. They've been around for 50 years, but the Korean War shows how close they came to changing. And I take that as a source of optimism. I would like to see, I'll say it, I'd like to see the North Korean regime change, not by force, but by its own people. I'd like to see a different regime there. And I don't think we should just simply presume that our alternatives are war or acceptance of things as they are. I think we should work with the Chinese to try to give the North Koreans voice in their own governance, which they don't have right now.
And you don't see the North Koreans, the people, losing patience with the regime and risking all to get a little bit more than what they have?
From what I've – and I'm no expert on North Korea, but from what I've read, I don't see how they could change that regime. I mean the authority that Kim Jong-il wields through the military is so absolute. There's talk of differences within the leadership. That's the only way I can see a change happening because the military controls all the resources. Poor, starving peasants don't make revolution. They can barely survive, unfortunately. So in this situation, without external support or without an internal breakup in the leadership, I don't see how change will occur.
It's not likely that there will be any fewer than two Koreas in the future then either.
Well, no, I think there could be one. I would not put off the possibility of North Korea collapsing of its own accord. I would not put off the possibility of the Chinese intervening or an internal dispute among leaders that then opens the door to change. I think those are likely scenarios. I don't think 20 years from now we'll be sitting here with a North Korean regime. Whether 20 years from now Korea will be a more stable or better place, I don't know. But I don't see how this regime can last in perpetuity unless we prop it up. And I hope that's not the route we're going.
Accidentally, somehow.
Right.
Jeremy Suri, thanks for being our guest. As always, it's just scratching the surface.
Right.
And I know you'll be back to talk about Henry Kissinger at a later point.
Yes.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next University of the Year.